Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got with us Eric Hulsher, who's, most famously of Read the Docs. Eric, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for inviting me.
It's a real honor. We always start with the sort of backstory and how people got into Django, and that's kind of the birth story of Read the Docs as well. So perhaps you could, run through the backstory. What's your origin story?
Sure. Yeah, I feel like I used to have this pretty well tuned, but it's like fading into the past each year.
It's like it's only on a Django podcast that it would get pulled up.
Well, no. Yeah, it's just time has a funny way of making the past a little fuzzier. I kind of learned Django in college. So I was doing a CS degree, and they didn't really teach Python or Django. I kind of actually knew Perl going into school, and then just was like, oh, I want to do some web stuff, maybe beyond CGI. And so kind of learned Django. I actually kind of downloaded the documentation as a PDF and took it on like a family vacation or whatever. So I had something to read on the plane.
So you must have printed that.
No, it's just like on a laptop The weighed probably like 8 pounds. and kind of that's, the documentation of Django is probably the thing that got me involved, being able to have that resource that I could just kind of download the PDF for free. I just kind of learned it, used it for my senior project in college, and then kind of out of university, applied at the Lawrence Journal World there in Lawrence, Kansas, for a job. And so then really kind of got deep into the Django world out there where it was created in Kansas. So yeah, I was there for a couple years, went to the first Django Con, did all that kind of stuff. So it was really kind of learned it in school, but then kind of really kind of got deeper into the community there in university and moved on, into my first job. So
okay. So there's two things you mentioned there is docs and communities. Let's go with Read the Docs. Let's get the headline out of the way. How did Read the Docs come up? Tell people what Read the Docs, just in case they don't know. But then how did that come up, and what was the origin of that?
Sure. So and those are both pretty similar in the narrative. So I mean, Read the Docs, really what it does is makes documentation hosting easier. So I was starting to write some open source projects, starting to put some docs together. And I think I had like a cron job running on my server that like pulled down the Git repo every hour and ran make HTML or whatever, like that was like deployment is like this cron job. And so we're like, hey, this is like a piece of technology, like webhooks have been a thing for a few years now. Like we've kind of built the plumbing to make the web a little more programmable. And that was really the core insight and still the core kind of concept, right? Is that, docs should rebuild automatically on push. That should all be kind of tied together. I mean, obviously now we have, pull request notifications, preview builds, all that kind of stuff. But back then it was really just that whole concept of building immediately on commit rather than some background process. And so that's what Read the Docs does. And then the core of that concept was really, the Django Dash was a 48-hour coding competition. And we were just able to kind of take that core insight and build it in 48 hours, right? It's like build a webhook receiver from GitHub, pull down the Git repo. Like the core of that's pretty simple. And so that was what was so attractive for a coding competition, is we were able to kind of put together that, very basic proof of concept in a weekend. So that was kind of the origin of the project as well.
But that's kind of amazing to because you a code sprint, so the Django Dash, 48 hours to put together what is kind of like a cornerstone of the Python, community. So in the, if you read a blog post about how to build a Python package, it's like, well, do docs and, read the docs. That's kind of cool, no?
Yeah, no, and I believe, I think I saw you had Jeff Triplett on a few weeks ago. He's someone I know from Lawrence, but then I know he's one of the maintainers of Django Packages, and I actually think Django Packages was created, Danny and Audrey,
during a Dash.
We're actually they lived in Lawrence at that time, and we worked in the same room on that Django Dash, like in the Lawrence Journal World basement where Django was created. Like it's a pretty cool kind of, confluence of events.
Okay. So can you tell us about how what's the scale now of Read the Docs? Because it's everything, right?
Yeah, so I mean, scale's a fun thing. There's a couple different metrics. I think we're doing, what is it, 500 million page views a year now? Something in that.
Is that internet scale, Carlton? Is that internet scale?
That'll do.
Oh no, sorry, 750 million. So 2021 we did 700 million, and that number kind of that's up from 580 the year before. So 2022 we'll definitely probably be doing over 750 million page views, and that is actual page views. That's not like requests, because each page view has lots of requests associated with it. I believe that's actually a Google Analytics number, and so that's undercounted as well.
Because everybody blocks Google Analytics.
Yeah, it's people block it. We respect do not track and don't inject it if you have that in your browser, all that good stuff. So yeah, I mean, probably closer to a billion page views.
And it's not just serving it though, it's like the building it, because you mentioned, so okay, every time I push to my main branch, you build my docs, but also if I so want, you'll build X branch, Y branch, Z branch, and every pull request. And like, how is that doable? It doesn't seem sustainable. So how is that managed?
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, we do, kind of for the past year, we've had about 8 people on the team. We're down to 6 at the moment because we did staff up a little bit. We got a Chan Zuckerberg grant for the last couple of years. And so we were able to have a little bit more staffing from the money there. But yeah, so the business itself, like I said, there's 6 people working on it full time at the moment, and that's all self-funded. And so about half of that money comes from advertising with ethical ads, which I know you talked to David about a little bit a couple years ago. And then the other half is we do have kind of a private hosted version. So companies or people with kind of public SaaS docs that, you know, don't want ads and want better support and some, you know, auth features, that kind of stuff. They're able to pay kind of for our private hosting as well. So similar to GitHub and all these other things, right? The kind of free for open source, paid for private. So
but while I've got you, so I'm a company director and I'm using GitHub, and I see they've got GitHub pages. What's the USP for Read the Docs for me? Why should I use Read the Docs?
Definitely the big thing is just kind of the core features that we're able to provide, you know, redirects, versioning, all that kind of stuff, and that kind of build and deploy step, right? GitHub pages doesn't do build previews, doesn't do all that kind of stuff. And you can do, you know, if you want to maintain like hundreds of lines of YAML and Python scripts and whatever, you can kind of hack it all together. But the nice thing with Read the Docs, right, is it's all integrated, it's all supported. You have somebody that will actually respond to your email. And then, the big thing is that kind of integration with building and deploying. And so we have a lot more hosting features, right, with GitHub pages. You basically are just, here's some HTML on the internet. You don't have any of the stuff we do. We do search indexing, we do all that kind of stuff. So it's a much more kind of fully integrated solution. But there's definitely people out there that if you want full control over it, right, you can hack it all together a million different ways yourself. So there's a wide range of deployment realities in the world.
but that cost of tacking it all together yourself is much more than the hosting cost of Read the Docs, right, on a monthly basis.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And I mean, it's going to be more likely to break. And then when it breaks, you have nobody to call, right? That's the big thing. I do think our support really sets us apart. You know, you send an email and almost always within, 4 to 6 hours, you're getting a reply with people who actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So I'm sure you've spoken of this elsewhere, but, you know, Read the Docs didn't have ads initially. You've had this growth. So looking back on it now, because how many years has it been? It's been quite a few years since you 12, I think, right?
I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2010, I believe, is when we started at summer 2010.
So I just curious how you look at, you know, the cost rising. You're not trying to profit maximize per se, so deciding to add ads, and then that gets to ethical ads, which I think would be good to talk about again, because that was 2 years ago. And to me, that's really cool. Like Jeff and I have talked about Django packages. If he does ads, he wants to do ethical ads. So I guess a loaded question of like, what was that journey like where you've got growth, but then you go, ooh, but costs are going up and we don't want to just spam up this thing that we have.
Totally. Yeah. No, I mean, I've talked a little bit about this over the years, but definitely, you know, I viewed advertising as kind of the the last option. we tried, you know, there's all these things on open source, how to fund it. You know, you can do these donation drives, you can do these support contracts that don't actually get anything, but like, it's a way to back channel money from corporations or,
yeah.
You know, we can do contracting, training, all this kind of stuff. And I have a blog post, which we can probably put in the show notes, but really like we tried a lot of these other models. And at the end of the day, they all distract. They either, you know, bring in almost no money. So like donations, lots of people have tried donations, and it's the, you know, you look at people's GitHub sponsors and it's like $32 a month or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's not going to sustain someone for a, you know, a full-time team working on this. And so, yeah, really advertising we kind of came to after trying other things. And what I really love about it is it the incentives are aligned to working on the product, right? You get more users, you get more people using the product, and you get more revenue. And it's not a distraction, right? You make the product better, and that leads to more revenue directly. Whereas so many other ways of monetizing open source, it's kind of this distraction where you're like, oh, we're going to do this like side business, but not actually work on the core product. And so I do, that's one of the big things that I love about advertising. And then to your point, right, like we are providing a service to the open source community, to our users. And if we start just putting incredibly intrusive ads, people are going to leave, right? So there's this tension where we feel that we need to kind of not add tracking, not kind of add to the data detritus in the universe. and so that was kind of the concept behind Ethical Ads, was kind of this, you know, no tracking. We only base the ad targeting is all done based on the content of the pages. So we actually, you know, parse the HTML that you're looking at, and actually kind of are able to target ads, right? If you're looking at a Django documentation page, we can put a Postgres database ad on it, or, you know, whoever else wants to target Django developers. We don't have to follow you around the internet and see that you're reading Django content for months on end. So.
Well, it's impressive to do that. I mean, because it's so easy at any company, at a startup I was at, which start growing. Once you put an ad on, you're never taking it off. Like, you're just going to be addicted to that revenue. And if you talk to, you know, Google or whomever, their only advice is bigger ads, more highly placed. So it really takes not just restraint, but yeah, discipline to say, I'm valuing this product. Because in the short term, yeah, the money's going to go up, but you can't always like put a dollar amount on the experience of users, right? But if over time they say, oh, it's just filled with ads, you've lost it. So anyways, I'm very in admiration that you've pulled that off, because I know as much as people say they want to do that, the realities of running a business, it's very difficult to do and requires thinking in 12-year plus terms to pull that off, you know, and no investors too, or not investors who aren't pushing you on that.
Totally. Yeah, no, if we were venture-backed, right, there would be someone who would definitely be like, you know, just put another ad in there and you get more revenue, right? It's a real easy solution. it's a very slippery slope. And similarly, like running the business as well, right? Like there are certain advertisers that will not advertise with us because they can't inject tracking. And that's not all nefarious, right? Some of that is fraud. The ad ecosystem is a mess. Like I don't fault advertisers for wanting to know where their ads are running, right? Like once you like put your ad into the ad tech machine, I would be terrified personally. Whereas like I have no idea where this is going to show up. Am I going to be on some news expose because my ad is running next to some alt-right content? Like, who knows? and so, you know, the ability to run a network that's invite only, that's, you know, like we know where all the ads are going and you know where they're going, right? It's not this algorithm where it's just could go show up on any page. And then similarly, as a publisher, right, you don't have random ads. Like if somebody was just browsing shoe ads and they come to your site, they're not going to see a shoe ad with Ethical Ads, right? They're going to see something tech related based on the content. And so that's the other big win, right, is not having that kind of cross-pollination, cross-contamination of the kind of rest of the world into our ecosystem, right? Like, it's really scary, but on both sides, as an advertiser, where your ads are going, and as a publisher, what is showing up on your site.
Yeah. Well, sorry, Carlton. I was just going to say, our discussion with David, we got into that a bit, so I'll link to that totally. For folks. Go ahead, Carlton.
I just have one question listening to you, though, just from a sort of advertiser's point of view, is how can I measure return on investment if you don't do any tracking and don't do all these, you know, so how does it come up that all this cross-site horribleness occurs? It's because I want to know that when you click, my, you know, I want to be able to allocate my money to that click or to that view. How can I measure that without any of the tracking?
Yeah. So, I mean, the big thing is, right, is once you click on an ad, we're out of the picture. like you can do whatever you want on your landing page. Mm-hmm. And we do allow people to put UTM codes and all that kind of stuff, right? So
to the sum
actually. Right, right. I mean, it's not tracking. It's just like a URL parameter that's like, this was, this click is attributable to this ad image and this ad copy, for example. But there's nothing, you know, personally attributable about that, about the user. But it does allow people to actually, you know, they understand like where the traffic is coming from and what is performing effectively. But they don't have any information about the publisher site, basically, right? So they don't kind of have that, yeah, that... The data doesn't cross from the publisher to the advertiser. It's just basically the advertiser's data that they're able to track on the back end of the click, if that makes sense.
Okay, cool. And so you've obviously got like a current setup, but it must have evolved over time. So what's your kind of guiding principle? Like how do you, you know, when a new suggestion comes up, what do you just run that through the how it tastes check or you...
That's a technical term, Carlton. Yeah.
Things have a taste, no? I mean, how do you decide? Oh no, actually, we're not going to do that. Versus, yes, we are. I guess. What's your moral compass?
So, do you mean on kind of the advertising ecosystem?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just in general.
So you know, the fruit company bring out a new device. It has this new ability to do X. Do we use that as part of our ad platform? I mean that. I'm trying to think of a particular example.
But. Maybe the place this comes up the most is in the kind of like publisher or kind of advertisers that we get on the network, right? There are some, you know, I have personal feelings about crypto, for example, and there's a lot of people who will come with things that are obviously scams. And we'll be like, okay, like we are not going to put red ads for your scam, even if you pay us lots of money, because like that's not okay. But then we don't have like a no crypto policy, right? We do kind of exercise judgment where it's like, okay, if you're building like a thing that looks like a real product, like we're happy to take ads for that. But like we do. And similarly for publishers as well, right? There's definitely some publishers who are like, definitely not, like that is whatever you're doing over there. Like we don't want to be a part of it. And so I guess that's where that kind of comes in the most frequently. And then in Read the Docs land as well, there's definitely a little bit of that, but not quite as much, but around, you know, censorship and, you know, the question of like hosting Russian content, all that kind of stuff, has been very relevant, recently. And so I do think there's a lot of interesting questions there that are becoming more and more relevant to people in open source. So,
yeah, is Russian content sanctioned at the moment? As an American,
But basically, Russian. I think the main issue we've actually hit is that Russian companies can't pay us.
Right. Okay. Because
so I do think we lost a couple customers because the kind of all the payment rails have all been removed. But yeah, we're not, to kind of answer that question, we're not doing anything beyond what is legally required. Right. We don't need to get too deep into the politics of it. But
no, I was just wondering if it was from a legal perspective, whether it was sanctioned, but yeah, it's the payment rails, as you say. So, perhaps to change, just aspect slightly.
Sure.
Can I ask about Sphinx? Cause you're still very much involved in the Sphinx world. And I love Sphinx. I use it.
You've given a talk on integrating it with Django, I believe, Carlson.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. So like, I have a little Django Sphinx view package, which just helps you, serve your Sphinx rendered content via the Django template language. So you can integrate it into your site, which may or may not be what you need, but that's what I needed. What I was going to ask is like, Sphinx is quite old and mature, and so it's both got the superpower, but also the cruft. And
it's very a lot like Django.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly. So, how's it keeping fresh, and what are the exciting technical developments in the Sphinx world?
Totally. Yeah. No, I think the biggest kind of exciting thing is definitely kind of the quality of the Markdown support that has been built for it. So this is actually also CZI money. This is the Executable Books project. And they're the ones who built JupyterBook. And they also built Myst, which is like we originally tried to do ReCommonMark, which is, you know, basically pulling Markdown content and generating in a DocuTils AST. So basically just that first step where you actually take the source from disk and turn it into something in memory. Basically, being able to have Markdown and RST both get turned into the same in-memory AST. And so we did a version of that originally, but they didn't have any funding, and it kind of started to get a little cruft, and it was a lot of work to maintain. And so it was really awesome that CZI was able to kind of fund that work. So they actually had some full-time people working on it for multiple years. And so the Markdown support within the Sphinx ecosystem has gotten really, really good. And so I think that's probably the most, you know, that's the biggest impediment that I think a lot of people have in terms of adoption or selling it with inside their or within their company.
Well, you say to people, so, yeah, they've got to use RST, and they're like, different link syntax.
Right. But then you show them what our Markdown looks like once it has all the features of RST, and it's like, oh yeah, this is really ugly too. But it's like, yes, that was, I like to say that about 50% of the complexity in RST is not needed. And 50% is there because there is just like a lot. It's doing a lot more than your like basic Markdown, right? Once you add directives, once you add these things that have a lot more complexity to them, like the syntax gets less pretty. But I do think there is some like unnecessary design decisions in RST. And so I really love kind of that Mist is able to kind of bridge that gap, right? Where you're able to take Markdown, you're able to introduce the complexity so people can still use Sphinx features. You can have a talk tree, you can have all that kind of stuff in your Markdown, and have it all kind of be pretty native. But then, yeah, it's all just Markdown at the end of the day.
Is there more that we should ask you about Sphinx? Because we wanted to ask about that, but then there's a whole host of other things to ask you about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing within the Sphinx ecosystem is definitely funding, right? Like we actually applied for a CZI grant to, because I think one of the questions I saw in the notes was kind of what's our relationship with Sphinx, right?
That, and so that
one
came of the from cool Jeff, thing... by the way. I asked Jeff, I was like, Jeff, what should I ask Eric? And he's like.
but one of the cool things about our CZI grant is that we did write some money in for helping with the Sphinx ecosystem around documentation specifically. So we actually contributed the Sphinx tutorial. For the longest time, Sphinx didn't actually have a tutorial. And so that was one of the things we were able to do with our grant. Same with Read the Docs, actually. We didn't have our own tutorial for the longest time. And so with that money, we were able to kind of contribute that to the Sphinx ecosystem. And we were really able to kind of dig a lot deeper into that relationship. Historically, we've helped, you know, we put a PR in here and there, but we're not super involved with the development. And so that grant money really did allow us to delve a little deeper into that. Then unfortunately, we applied for a larger Sphinx-specific grant, and that actually wasn't accepted by CZI. So that was, we were really hoping to be able to kind of start to build a little bit more in the ecosystem. One of the big, there's a lot of really wonderful extensions for Sphinx that nobody knows about.
Yeah,
and that kind of like that ecosystem management, I think, is a huge missing piece. Testing those across releases, you know, Pradian, who's done some wonderful work with the Furo theme. I think that's one of the other really exciting things lately is the Furo theme has become a really, really wonderful version of a Sphinx theme that's pretty modern. And so that's probably the other exciting thing. But he's also worked on sphinxthemes.org, which actually gives you like a fully rendered list of all the themes with a mobile view and a dark mode and all that kind of stuff as well. So.
Yeah, he's done a super job there. We'll link to that.
I was just going to say, it sounds like you have a really good relationship over the years with CZI. I'm just thinking, you know, Django has no relationship with them. And yet these things you've mentioned, funding for docs, you know, all these other things, you know, so Django itself, I mean, listeners know we go on about this. We're about to have the JetBrains promotion tomorrow, June 1st. So this will come out, I think, a week after. But Django is sort of makes enough to do what it needs to. But in terms of having a docs fellow, having more tutorials, having accessibility, all these things, we haven't been able to sort of tee that up and identify sources of funding outside of Kickstarters or putting ads on the site, which we don't want to do. You know, we had like Carbon ads to speak of one, you know, they're for, you know, vertical focused on tech, and like Vue.js just redesigned their docs and it's in the sidebar. And, you know, Carbon helpfully sent us a thing saying, hey, your sidebar would look great with Carbon ads. And, you know, we could do that. But anyway, just as a, it's interesting to think of the ecosystem of funding out there. I mean, Django has gotten grants from, frankly, random foundations.
Yeah, Mozilla, I believe.
Mozilla, but just some place somewhere in the Midwest we have no connection with. They'll just send us sometimes $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 to help. But we're not as, you know, we're not able to, we're so small, we can't be proactive about that. And so I guess to lead into a specific question, you've been involved with the PSF, the Python Software Foundation, just to, I believe as a director, and then also a working group around funding. So I send that over to you as, you know, what can Django take from your experience at the larger organization dealing with these issues?
Sure. So just a quick note on the differentiation between us and Carbon, which I know you wanted to ask, but
it's important to tell listeners. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean the big thing is privacy, right? Like Carbon is able to have larger advertisers because they are perfectly happy to inject Google JavaScript into your website. So that is the big difference between us is we're actually saying no to those advertisers and losing that revenue.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely, you know, I highly respect Carbon. I think they do a wonderful job. Like they do a lot of really great work in the ecosystem. BSA is, I believe, bootstrapped by Sell Ads, which is their parent company. So a lot of respect. I respect them a lot as a competitor because they have a wonderful product that we're trying to compete with. But yeah, I do just want to note, I think a lot of people have the understanding that Carbon has the same approach to privacy that we do. And that is not the case. So, but to move on from that.
Well, I should say that.
I think it's good to bring out the differentiator. I think that's, you know, important.
Well, I think a lot of people they look the same, right? And people think they are the same. And I think that's one of the big things we've had trouble with is trying to really kind of convey the privacy aspects that we're, you know, we're basically losing money over, you know, preserving the fact that your website should not send data to Google unless you agree to send that data to Google.
Well, do you see, I mean, so DuckDuckGo, right? That would be an obvious comparison in terms of how they've managed things. Is there, what do you take away from there, from that experience, right? I mean, I remember back when I was in San Francisco, even they had the budget for billboards, and you know, actually, I think they just got some flack because they have a native.
They're not blocking Microsoft trackers.
Yeah. But anyways, I imagine you look closely at the DuckDuckGo and other relationship because it's sort of the same thing, except now they're. It seems from the outside they've grown enough that they're maybe having, and they have funding, outside funding, for a while. Totally. So, yeah, maybe down the line you get to that scale and it's like, oh, okay, it's the same issues, but how do I handle it and be different?
Yeah, well, I must say, if we were just competing against Google, it would be much easier. Like Google is very easy to compete against. However, Carbon actually is a great product, and so I do think that I envy the competition with Google because So I don't know if that answers your question, but I do think that, you know, we have a harder time differentiating because there are other people providing a similar user experience for advertising, and Carbon does a great job with that. Like I do. As a competitor, they are a hard one to compete with because they do a great job. So yeah, well, I do think that DuckDuckGo, yeah, maybe had... It's easier to compare and contrast with Google.
Right. Well, I guess because it's not just that the privacy thing, it's that, you know, Google, you have to scroll down a full page to see an organic result, whereas DuckDuckGo isn't there yet. Whereas I guess, you know, a sidebar thing could look the same for Carbon versus Ethical Ads, even though under the hood,
yeah,
it's quite different.
Yeah. Yeah, but I didn't want to sidebar too much on ad stuff again. But I'll kind of pivot back towards grant stuff because I do think that's super interesting as well.
Well, this was the sort of thing. It's like, what can Django take? I mean, you've been very active in, you know, I've followed you for ages talking about open source funding, and you half talked about it before. I mean, what, you know, is that? It seems like it's the Gordian knot. Like, how do we resolve this? Is it resolvable? Like,
yeah. So, I mean, I can only say positive things about CZI. Like I in particular love that they're funding nuts and bolts. So much grant funding is like Kickstarter, right? It's like, hey, we're going to build a new shiny thing. We want the shiny thing. You want to fund the shiny thing, and you're going to put the shiny thing on your website. And so like, and then it's like, oh, we're just spent all our time building the shiny thing. And like, our like CI has been broken for 3 months, but like, look at this new feature or whatever, you know? And I love that CZI has really kind of embraced that, you know, this money needs to go into maintenance. It needs to go into the stuff that's not sexy. And I really love that aspect of the program. And I really respect that. The The hard thing with Django is Read the Docs is heavily used in the scientific ecosystem, and CZI, that's really their mission. They're funding scientific research, right? So we were able to basically say, hey, look, Jupiter, NumPy, X-Array, you know, like these core scientific like ecosystem projects are using Read the Docs, they're using Sphinx. So this money is going to be infrastructure funding for science. And so that was really how we were able to get that grant money. And so there is a lot of money in that ecosystem, scientific stuff. There's the Ford Foundation. There's, you know, the Sloan Foundation. There's a lot of money around grants, you know, in the tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. NASA just announced a big program. I know Europe, the US government is doing a lot more work around this funding, but a lot of it is focused on that science work. And so that was kind of how we were able to kind of sneak in that funding mechanism, right? Is because our tooling is heavily used in the scientific ecosystem. I think Django probably has a little bit of a harder sell there. But yeah, I think that's one of the goals with our working group, right? When I joined the PSF board, kind of my big goal was funding. And I actually worked to kind of, I kind of got that original Moss grant from Mozilla over the line with the PSF. And that was really the first big grant that we were able to get and show success from. And that really kind of snowballed, right? It's once you have success, you can sell more success, right? You're like, hey, look at this money and look what it got us. And that's the core thing, right? Is being able to kind of tell that story. So you go to the next funder, which is CZI, for example, with some of the PIP improvements. And you're like, look what we did with this Mozilla money. Now we can get the CZI money. And then actually with the CZI money, they've been able to then actually go towards private corporations and say, hey, Facebook, you're worried about, you know, like supply chain? Hey, Google, you worried about supply chain? Like, give us money. And so then they're able to, you know, then bring in, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of private money to work on that kind of core infrastructure. But it really is kind of the snowball. And that was kind of the theory that we were working on back when we first started applying for grants. But that's really kind of what's been able to be executed there. And so the goal, you know, we kind of put that together, and then I stepped down from the board. And then I did actually start working on the project funding working group, which was to try and kind of bring that knowledge of funding into the ecosystem a little bit more widely. And I'd say we're medium successful at that. but it is really like there is a lot of money out there, but grant funding is a whole different thing. But I do think having that longer term vision of, like, you know, you can't just rely on grant funding. Like, there needs to be some kind of longer runway.
Yeah. And in some ways, because the money is so big, I mean, I think it's easier for Microsoft or some of these places, it's much easier to write $1 million check than $100,000 one, because just the logistics of it. And in terms of, or as I see the ecosystem, on the one hand, you have the PSF and all this work that's been done, so you can point to all these things and say, yeah, we did a follow-up report. And the other, and then there's Django, and then kind of at the bottom end, maybe it's Django REST framework, where Tom Christie can say, hey, it's just me, this might go away unless you do something. And Django is kind of in the middle, where we don't have the resources to fully fund what grant payers need, right? They need someone to write the grants and do the follow-up, and we don't really have that yet. And at the same time, we're not going away anytime soon. So it sort of has us treading water financially, which maybe is fine, because we're, you know, keep pumping out releases, but there's things we're not doing.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I think the Tom Christie kind of DRF model is super fascinating, because really, really what Tom is selling is a developer that works on your core product dependency for like pennies on the dollar. Because that's basically the pitch, right? It's like, hey, your like whole back end of your website is built on DRF. Your mobile app is all API driven by DRF. Like, you want to see that continue to improve. You want that dependency to get better and better. And by giving us $500 a month, if, you know, 50 other companies give us $500 a month, you all get the same product. You get a full-time developer working on this release for, you know, or not even that much. I mean, $50 a month, $100. I did the math wrong on that. But yeah, like that's really the narrative that I think DRF is working within. And I think that's super compelling personally, because I find that kind of that business case, right? I do think with grant funding, with any kind of private corporate funding, right? The PSF is getting money because like supply chain security is a big deal. And like, it's still a fraction of the money they should be getting, but it's still, you know, they're solving that core business need. And I think that's really the big thing, right? Is grant funding, you know, private donations. It's still sales. you still have to kind of be solving a problem that organization needs solved. And I do think that's somewhere where Django struggles a little bit, right? Is and Read the Doc struggles in this way sometimes as well. It's like you're almost too foundational.
Yeah, you're too people stable, like, too mature.
like people don't yeah, they don't feel the pain or sense the pain of it going away. But then it's also, yeah, you're not at the project life cycle where the new shiny thing is like a super obvious, like Django migration Kickstarter, obvious shiny thing.
Yeah. But I think you mentioned it before, is that you do something to raise money, which is a distraction from the core project. So I'm 100% convinced that if we go, you know, if we say, hey, do you use Django? You do. Oh, brilliant. Why don't you fund the, you know, if we go out and do that fundraising effort, we could double or triple the number of corporate sponsors of the DSF, small agencies around, bigger companies that are using it, of the DSF. But who in the Django community has got that time and skill set to go out there and make those fundraising calls? Nobody. You know, there's people contributing to the framework, there's people, you know, working on it. But that sales job is entirely distinct. It's a totally different skill set.
Well, I think it's also, I mean, sort of like you, Carlton and I are a bit of a broken record on this topic. I mean, the fact that Read the Docs now has full-time employees, no one outside of a very small number of people knows how Django is actually structured, and why should they? But it makes it hard to, you know, DRF, you can say, oh, it's Tom. I mean, of course it's Tom and Carlton and others, but it's made, you know, that's easier to think about. Like Django seems this like amorphous thing. It doesn't seem like it's going away, and it seems harder to just to know and care why things are happening. It's almost a branding problem. I almost think if we on the website described how it's like on the homepage or something more prominent and said, hey, this is the entire budget for Django is basically $200,000 a year. Like,
yeah, there's a lot.
That's less than a Django dev makes in most major cities.
Yeah. Developers are scared to like promote things.
Yeah.
Like the fact that I can go to the Django project website and not see a logo of a sponsor is a failure, because the big thing I've also learned, like with ethical ads, the biggest revenue generation, the biggest awareness we have is the ads, right? So by highlighting your sponsors, you're showing that you have a sponsorship program.
Right.
And like there's the thing on the sidebar, right? That's like some random Django developer gave us like $2 and it's like, okay, great. Like I can give Django $2. That's what you're telling me. But if I went to the Django project website and there was like a huge Google logo at the bottom and it was like top tier sponsors, I'd be like, oh, like that's a thing. I want my company logo there. Maybe I'll email my manager or whatever. But I do believe increasing the visibility. It's very like, it's antithetical to a lot of what developers think about in the world. But like increasing the visibility of sponsorship actually leads to more sponsorship, which, I mean, once you think about it,
yes,
makes sense.
Yes.
But like,
yeah,
nobody in the developer community is like, I'm going to put a PR together to put the sponsor logos on the webpage.
Well, this is, I mean, you're on the DRF members list where I sent something around recently. I mean, Carlton, I've had many discussions. I mean, that is the obvious, easy thing to do is to, like Vue.js, you know, have the sponsors instead of buried on some page no one can see, somewhere on the homepage, and then just put, you know, instead of a random person, have some prominence for a certain tier, put to the sidebar. But getting, you know, as you know, communicating a financial need when it's not like you're going to run out of money tomorrow, but you kind of do need it. Like as treasurer of Django the last 3 years, like I would like us to have more than less than a 1 year runway if something happened, you know, that's not great actually.
And I mean, we've actually been working with the PSF, like the PSF is using our hosted ad platform with ethical ads to put sponsor logos on every PyPI sidebar or PyPI. Like every time you go to a PyPI project in the sidebar, there is a logo for a sponsor, and if you click on that, it goes to the page with sponsorship.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And that is really them they're working with us and work with them to promote the visibility of their sponsors to get more sponsorship and to provide value, right? I do think the idea of having your logo on the PyPI package index is valuable to sponsors.
Yeah. So that I mean, like Django packages too.
Yeah. Or if you're a Django shop, if you're a Django using company, to be on the Django website is a great way of drawing potential hires.
I mean, it's a huge value add to sponsors. And then you put that in your prospectus, right? Like that is a thing when I go to my boss and they're like, wait, why should we give Django money? It's like, well, because we use it, obviously, because we're good people. But like the good people argument, like, does not sell. Like people love being good people. And so they'll give $10 to like some charity, you know, once a year. But like, if you actually want to get companies to engage with, you know, 5-6 figures, like you need to give them that visibility and you need to give them something they can sell, right? They need to be able to justify it when they go to their boss, right? It's like, what's the cool screenshot I can send to my boss in an email that's like, hey, I'm so glad we did this deal. Look at all the value we're getting.
Right. And
like,
all the traffic. The issue for Django is we have Carlton 3 days a week, Marius 5 days a week, and then the board who are volunteers, and that's it. So for example, Carlton, I have, it's documented, said, okay, once 4.1 is out, which Carlton's the release manager for, hopefully we can find some time. So Carlton and I can work on this, you know, and Carlton can do it. There isn't someone else to rejigger the homepage. There isn't someone to rejigger the sidebar experience. So it comes out of, you know, it'd be nice to have a grant and have someone else do it. But Carlton, what do you think? I mean, right?
Is we've got Eric on this week confirming that this is exactly what we need to do. So if we can just get someone from a design agency on, anyone want to come on? And then they can like step up and redo the site. And then, you know, hey, presto, it's done. The bottom line is it shouldn't be me redesigning. I can tweet, I can do little tweaks, I can put a page together, but I'm not redesigning the site. I'm not re-information architecting it. Like, I just... I haven't got the time and the skill set to do that.
Maybe you've conned me into doing the work myself because I do. I'm on the DSF members list and I do very little for Django. But no, it's like simple things.
People to do that though. That's the thing. Like as a board member, our whole last couple of meetings is, hey, people aren't doing stuff. And it's like, well, we don't ask them to, right? There's 200 members. They're not asked to do much. I sent an email kind of raising a flag and, you know, I think we're really hurting from the lack of in-person meetings, personally.
Yeah, no, COVID has really kind of changed the dynamics. The reward you get from going to a sprint or something is a lot less. The dopamine hits are not as strong.
Even you know, like, okay, so like let's redesign Django Project site. Okay, so how does that actually happen, right? Like, I'm on the board. I guess we could just decide, but I would rather have discussions with like prominent Django people at DjangoCon, talk about in the members. You know, there's this, because it's not a dictatorship, you sort of like, well, I could start on it, but I kind of know the pushback I'm going to get. And since it's all volunteer work, it's a lot of work to do on a maybe instead of somehow getting everyone to say, yeah, we need to redesign it. And here's these finalists and who's going to PM it and all the rest. It's, you know, in the absence of in-person meetings, it just becomes harder to push that through.
Well, it's impossible to push through even with in-person meetings. I mean, I saw some of the background of the Python website redesign.
Yes.
And that was a huge amount of work. And I think within open source, get like governance, authority, like who actually feels empowered that they could actually change the website is a huge question, right? Like it's one of the hardest things about open source is like who feels they have the authority to add, say you put ads on the Django project website, like who feels that they could actually make that decision, right? And I don't think anybody does in some way. I mean, there's like a legal person, there is a person who has that legal authority, but do they feel empowered to
You're talking to them, I think, so you know.
But that is a classic thing, right? It's like who feels empowered to make that process, and then executing, doing a web design or redesign is super hard. Like even for people with infinite funding, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So it is don't feel bad because it is a hard problem. But I do also want to like step back in scope and like, I know there's a thread in the website or in the DSF chat about like redesigning the website, but like, I'm not talking about redesigning the website. I'm talking about like putting the logos on the current website.
Yeah, it's the homepage and the sidebar. Yeah,
changing the link at the top that says donate to sponsor, because donate is not like donation is a like, no. Do not use that word. That word is bad. That means I am a corporation and I get no value. what you want is you want sponsors. And your members can be sponsors. It doesn't mean they have to give, you know, you can be a $5 a month sponsor or whatever. But I do believe that like donation as a concept is something that like corporations equate with like a different budget than sponsorship. Like sponsorship's marketing money. Donation is like we do a matching fund for our employees' budget. Sponsorship is how you actually give value to people. Like, is there a prospectus? Like, if I'm a company, what do I get when I give you money? Like, is there something I can then send to my boss to be like, hey, I think we should be a bronze level. I mean, it's the exact same thing as a conference sponsorship, right? You need the prospectus, you need sponsorship, you need value. And the PSF has been doing a lot of work kind of adding, like selling sponsorships and merging conference and community benefits, which is really kind of interesting. We've done some of that with Write the Docs as well, where we actually sell, you know, job postings as part of a conference sponsorship that shows up on our community job board to try and kind of spur the usage of that job board.
Yeah.
And so much of this, right, is super basic, but it's really hard, right? If you're just a bunch of developers and you're like, how do I build a sponsorship program?
Like, well, it's it's also not that, you know, it's why do we have fellows? It's all the stuff that needs to get done that isn't as fun to do, right? Like, all those, you know, and for me, like, I would really like to see these things happen, but I, like, personally don't have the time to do it on top of being the treasurer and all the things I'm doing. So one thing, which I, you know, I saw you did, one path I might take is to step down from the board and to try to work specifically on some of these things so that I have the time to do it and I'm not doing all the other things I need to do. So it's, yeah, but you know, we need the prospectus. We need the sidebar. I think also at this point, something, you know, it's also as a volunteer, it is, I think we would get more people if we had bigger, audacious public goals. It's less enticing to keep something going as a volunteer than it is to, you know, redesign the site, improve the corporate thing, you know, do a new feature. Carlton's shaking his finger at me, but
well, it's kind of what Eric just sort of intimated out before is that if as soon as it becomes redesign the site, then that's a massive job. Whereas put the sponsor logo on the front page, that's an addressable.
Well, this is what
kind
we've,
of small thing. You know, and we have this thing with feature issues, right? So a feature issue comes on. Sorry, let me just say this point, because it is exactly like adding a new feature. It's like, can we, I don't know, add this little tweak thing to the admin? Yeah, we can add that little tweak thing, but can we add this whole new major feature? No, we can't. So it's much more addressable to do the one little tweak than it is the big, you know, oh, let's boil the ocean.
Well, the plan currently is, Carlton, for you and me and others to look at something different for the homepage and correct the sidebar, not a redesign, and ask for forgiveness, not permission, or ask people to comment, which they probably won't, and then see what happens. But I know it's going to help our...
Just ship it, and then you'll get all the comments.
We're like, yeah. Well, now you commented. I mean,
We already did it.
I put it on a feature flag, so you can just ship it for a day and be like, all right, we'll address the wave of criticism. And
Yeah, okay.
I mean, we are, though, compared to the Python Software Foundation, as you noted, there has been this big shift from generally most of the funding came from the conferences. And then, that's a weakness in general. And then with COVID, that's a real problem. Django has never made much money from the conferences. So in a way, that's more stable for us, even though that is, you know, that's something we could and should do, right? Like, we could have part-time paid hourly staff and make the conferences more of a job fair for businesses. It's just a question of who's going to do that. But in any event.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of really interesting questions here. And I will note this is one of the reasons why Read the Docs is a for-profit and not a nonprofit. Because I actually have some probably unpopular opinions around the incentive structures and kind of public perception around nonprofits. But I actually do think being a nonprofit constrains the way you can make revenue and changes people's perception of when you actually try to generate revenue, along with the tax implications and legal things and whatnot. But like when people hear you're a nonprofit, that it's just a different conversation. I mean, you can hire people, you can do all the work, but I do think that makes things a little bit harder, at least at the small scale. But anyway, that's 1,000% sidebar.
No, I 1,000% agree. I mean, even coming, I just came from a business school reunion. In business school, I took a class on nonprofits, and my takeaway was it's twice the work because you have to do all the things of a for-profit, plus all the extra requirements of a nonprofit, plus people don't want you to make too much money. So it's just, you know, like for me, like I do books and education, and I've thought, well, maybe I should do a nonprofit, right? Maybe it should be like free code camp. But just the logistics of that cost, you know, you're replacing people who pay you with sponsors and donors who are less reliable. And, you know, again, you get these big spikes, but then you get these troughs. And I personally, if I ever did like a free code camp kind of site, I would make it a for-profit and charge for like 5% of it or something, or have sponsors, you know, ads, right? It just, an actual nonprofit is just so much work.
Yeah. But I do think that's one of the things, right? That's part of why it's also hard to define. I mean, it's still just a legal entity, just like a for-profit. It just has a board that controls it. But I think it's just a lot harder for people to understand that it's like, it also has its own needs. It needs fundraising. It needs revenue. Like, I mean, for the DSF in particular, what is overhead? I'm sure is a fraught question.
Well, no, I mean, well, you're on the members list. I mean, and this is partly, I guess, my fault, or just, you know, we don't, you know, the PSF has an annual report that says, here's who got paid what, and here's the budget. And we have that now since I've been there and working with, working on that. But I haven't done a blog post to share it publicly, right? I probably should. You know, it's not a mystery. It's 2/3 fellows and then 1/3 everything else. But because people don't know that and see that, even the DSF members, why would they know that, right? So it's, I guess, on me, yeah, a little bit.
And like, who's, I'm also the, like, one of the like five people on that list probably that even knows what a 990 is. And like,
well, yeah, you know, exactly. Yeah, like, I now have to file that, and you know, so it's just an invisible pain, yeah, for the past treasures.
We're getting a little deep in the weeds here, but I do think that in some ways, yeah, like that amorphousness is really hard, because it does make it a little harder to figure out where you fit in and how you're going to generate funding. And there are a lot of funding opportunities, especially with grants, that are only available to nonprofits. And so there are some benefits there as well, of course. But yeah, I don't want to go too far down the nonprofit rabbit hole, because it's pretty arcane.
Well, but I mean,
it's interesting.
It's the only, there's this, Catherine Holmes, who's the DSF assistant. So she's paid hourly. That was added since I joined. That's basically the only way I can do the job, or anyone could do the job. Before me, there was people came in and out, because it is, even for me, it's hours a week, and she's doing, you know, she's physically filing the 990. I'm reviewing it, you know, so I'm sort of, even though I've long said I never want to manage anyone, I'm managing her a little bit, but yeah, that's why it happens. So yeah, anyways, yes, all these things that matter, and that, you know, regular users don't need to know, but DSF members, I think, should know more about. And so that's really probably on the board to communicate the needs.
And I think that's one of the back benefits of having people on the board, is they actually have to learn about nonprofits.
Yeah. And at the same time, having this year, we have the same people as last year. We're most likely going to institute a change where it's 2-year terms, because if you're just on for a year, it basically takes a year to learn how to do anything, and then you can finally do something. So this year has been great in that we've been able to just do stuff instead of bring people up to speed on what an
ARPA. Surely it should surely be 3-year terms then, 1 year to learn and 2 years to do something. Otherwise, well,
that's, yeah, that's I think PSF is 3-year. Yeah.
Well, there you are. It makes it. I just wanted to, this, I mean, you know, all the nonprofit stuff,
yeah, yeah,
there, it's kind of interesting, but what, one thing it does tie into that I think, you know, is more open and perhaps a, you know, way to segue out of there, is that part of the Django sort of feel is the community, and how, I don't know, what's your take on it, on that, Eric, in terms of, I kind of feel that the nonprofit and the way Jacob and Adrian would have stepped away from the BSDF role and all of that kind of thing, BSDF,
yeah, yeah, benevolent BDSF. BDFL.
Well, yeah, BDFL. That was not, it.
There's but other things similar to that these days, we won't say. Yeah.
Anyway. oh, I don't know how to turn that into a question.
Benevolent dictators for life. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. But like, how that's said, Dwayne, like, aren't the two? Don't the two go hand in hand? Like, you can't really have the sort of Django community without the sort of the foundation and the nonprofit status and it being the way it is.
I mean, there's nothing like Write the Docs, which is the conference I work on in the community, is a for-profit organization. There's nothing about the governance or the legal entity. Like for-profit companies actually have more flexibility in terms of being charitable.
Right, okay.
If we choose however we want to spend the money, even if the IRS doesn't think it's okay. Like, we pay taxes and we do whatever we want. Like, cool. And so I do think that, like, this is part of what I'm talking about, right? People conflate the legal status with the mission, with a bunch of other things that are all wrapped up in how they think about it. And it just makes it a little harder to communicate clearly with people. The need for, we're going to pay somebody to raise money as a nonprofit is like probably a little harder than saying as a business, we're going to do a salesperson or whatever.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I do think there are people in the community that have this skill set. But yeah, it's just like, it's not a skill set people do for free generally. Like,
right.
No, and why should they? Why, you know, even
like, I'm going to raise money for your organization and then you're going to give me none of it. Wait, is that, it's like even weirder and more awkward with money. You're like, oh, so my job is to generate revenue and get paid nothing. Oh, great. This makes a ton of sense. but yeah, no, I think that there's a lot of small things that the DSF could do to better convey the value it provides. And I think the donate page does a great job, but like, it just needs to be more pervasive throughout all of the content, all of the kind of marketing, all the communication. And so, yeah, but these are things every organization struggles with, right? Like, I don't want to make it sound like it's easy.
Well, it sounds like you volunteered to review our draft this fall is what it sounds like to
well,
me.
Well, could I ask you to do a brain dump when you get off, you know, when you get off and brain dump it to the DSF list? So at least we've got an action. It's a, for, you know, you don't have to, but if you did, that would be amazing.
No, I'm definitely, there's lots of ideas here. And obviously I've been failing at blogging for a long time. So maybe that's the proper avenue for these thoughts. To finally get a blog post out this year.
Well, we're coming up on time. What haven't we asked you, right? I mean, what do you want to tell people about that we haven't teed up?
I'm a little sad that we had the PCT on the notes and hiking stuff. But
let's talk about it. Okay, so I saw that, and so you've done, so the Pacific Crest Trail runs on the West Coast, and well, Jacob did the whole thing, and you did 800 miles of it.
No, hang on. That just sounds like an awful long way. So go back a sec. What is this?
It's a hiking trail.
The PCT runs 2,600 miles from Mexico to Canada along the US coast, basically. But yeah, and I did 800 miles and ended up breaking my foot by walking too much. I got a stress fracture. So that was, did not choose to stop, but
Which section did you do? The north, south, or south north?
South north. So basically I did the worst part.
Yeah, because I've done the John Muir Trail, which is like the best part, which is only 220 miles from Yosemite to Mount Whitney. So you didn't get to Mount Whitney then?
I got to Whitney, so I went out at Kearsarge Pass. So yeah, I got
that's the next one basically.
Yeah, the PCT is like 700 miles of desert, like in the south, and then you finally get to the High Sierra, and that's like the best part, and you're in good shape and you're like ready, you're doing 20 miles a day. And then my like foot just like stopped working and I was like, nah. So I did some at Whitney and got to do that. That kind of saw the beginning of the
Guitar Lake and then to Kearsarge. Yep.
But unfortunately,
can you just put a marker in the ground and go back a few years later and pick it up and say, this is where I was, I'm carrying on?
Oh yeah, totally. I'd go right back in the same pass if I wanted to. But yeah, it's hard to find the time to take 5 months off to hike across the country.
But people do this, Carlton. So on the East Coast, there's the Appalachian Trail from Maine to Georgia, which literally I just was just home at my parents' house. It literally goes in front of my parents' house in Vermont. And my wife hiked the entire thing after college. I only did a bit of it with her. And people, though, many people can't take the time to do the whole thing. So they'll section hike it and they will go it becomes very specific, right? Like you can't skip a section, right? If you're going to do it, you're going to do it. So it may take 10 years, but you want to do the whole thing.
Totally. But yeah, just a fun little, lots of hikers, I think, in the open source community. But yeah, that's definitely something I still do almost every weekend and enjoy. So that's how I'm able to kind of do so much work, is to, you know, get the endorphins on the weekend, I guess.
Well, if you're going to sit still, you have to move around on the, you know, it's like everything's yin yang.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, Carlton, you would agree, Mr. Philosophy?
I did Western philosophy. Yeah, no, I mean, I do good touches.
I know you have a quote of someone from 2000 years ago.
I do Alpine philosophy.
All sounds very sensible.
Yeah. Well, so we're going to have links to everything. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for just not just the ideas, but just inspiring me, Carlton, others to do the work on Django, because especially around funding, like there's so much opportunity. It's just a question of seeing role models like Read the Docs and trying to tackle the easy things to, you know, keep it secure, which is what we all want going forward.
Yeah, no, well, thank you for coming on.
Security is a great sales pitch. A plus.
Yes, just don't be. Yeah. All right. Well, we are. I was just going to say,
security, like the security team who, you know, don't get much daylight, they do a massive job. We get reports every single week. And, you know, there's experienced developers giving time there. Like that, if we were to put that work more front and center, there's a thing that, you know,
we could have an unsecure version, right? Like the free version of Django versus the premium version.
You can't pay for security. It's not a feature.
I feel like this is a whole other thread that we're gonna jump onto that we don't have time for. But I do think it's a great kind of avenue, though, right? To kind of highlight that work.
Yes, to highlight it
and put it forward. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna say we are at DjangoChat.com, chat Django on Twitter. This is actually our last live episode of the spring. We will be back in the fall. So we'll put out replay episodes. But Eric, thank you so much for taking the time.
Totally. Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.